We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on hot topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
State Farm Insurance knows that understanding and investing in our cultural identity is paramount in protecting our future. We know what it's like to go from nothing to something, to wish that we had better financial literacy when we were younger. Luckily, State Farm is here to help with funding programs like Project Ready, which is committed to education achievement and has already awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers to Black and Brown youth since 2021. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream.
Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work. In traffic, so slow.
Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Moments like seeing my son's team cheer him on mean a lot to me. But after being diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, or MBC, which is breast cancer that has spread to other parts of the body, they mean even more. I take Ibrance, palbociclib.
Ibrance 125 milligram tablets with an aromatase inhibitor is for adults with HR positive HER2 negative MBC as the first hormonal-based therapy. Ask your doctor about Ibrance and visit Ibrance.com. Ibrance may cause low white blood cell counts that may lead to serious infections. Ibrance may cause severe inflammation of the lungs. Both of these can lead to death. Tell your doctor right away if you have new or worsening symptoms, including trouble breathing, shortness of breath, cough, or chest pain. Before taking Ibrance, tell your doctor if you have fever, chills, or other signs of infection, liver or kidney problems, are or plan to become pregnant, or are breastfeeding. Common side effects include low red blood cell and low platelet counts, infections, tiredness, nausea, sore mouth, abnormalities in liver blood tests, diarrhea, hair thinning or loss, vomiting, rash, and loss of appetite.
Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Charlamagne Tha God. We are the Breakfast Club. We got some special guests joining us this morning.
Yes, indeed.
We got Ryan Coogler and Peter Nix. Welcome, fellas.
What's up? Thanks for having us.
How y'all feeling?
Feeling good.
Feeling good?
Yeah, man.
Happy to be invited.
New documentary, yeah. Anthem.
Yeah, man. I've long felt like the national anthem, like most things in America, need to be changed to represent the world we currently live in. Clearly, y'all felt the same, which is why the doc was created, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're in a time right now where we're examining our identity, you know, searching for our identity, trying to express it in different ways. And there's a lot of collisions in how we express those identities. And that the moment felt right to inquire and to go a little bit deeper on, you know, the history of that song and also the opportunity to imagine what an anthem would be like for today that reflects the American story.
What made you dive deep into the anthem, right? Because we're in school, you learn it, you don't really think much of it. This was very knowledgeable because it taught where the origin came from. When you're a student, they don't teach you the origin, they just say sing it, you know what I mean? So what made y'all dive deep into actually understanding, learning, and to even discuss this?
I've been looking at a couple of projects that were examining this collision between patriotism and protest, and obviously we're seeing it in the headlines every day. I've always wanted to make a music doc, number one, and the anthem seemed like a perfect stage to examine the American voice and the American story, and also this notion that music does bring us together, and that maybe a project using music as an exploration of the American story could in some way reflect some idea of optimism in this difficult time that we're in right now.
I'm learning that, I guess stand-up comedy is such an inspiration for creative minds like yourself, because Anthem seems to be rooted in a bit from Roy Woods Jr. And then y'all walked in and y'all said y'all was out last night watching Chappelle and Chris Rock. So what is it about comedy that sparks those seeds?
I don't know. I think, personally, I think like stand-up is probably like the highest form of storytelling with like a high degree of difficulty.
Absolutely.
You know? Mm-hmm. But it's also a form where you can, you know, where you can ask questions. And Roy is brilliant, man. Mm-hmm. He hosted our after party. But yeah, that bit is kind of incredible. Like it's, for some reason in that setting, they can ask questions and kind of make criticisms plain, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was asking, yo, if you know, what you know, it's based off of this, you know, it's not even an American tune, not even an American song. It's based off a British drinking song. I didn't know that either.
I didn't know that to the film. That's why I said it's so knowledgeable. You learned so much about the film.
Yeah.
And what made you be a part of this film? You know,
finish the stand-up point for us, though.
I think stand-up, like when you laugh, when you have a natural reaction, sometimes it's nervous. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes it's like, man, I can't believe this person said this. You know, it was a lot of that last night. but at the same time, like oftentimes it's like a recognition of something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In someone's storytelling. And that bit, it just leads, you know, if you watch the film, it leads right into, mm-hmm. you know, right into the story. Mm-hmm. How I got involved, Pete and I met in Oakland over 10 years ago. I was making a film called Fruitville. It was Fruitville then, now it's Fruitville
Station.
Everything
about you is Oakland, bro. It all comes back to Oakland. Doesn't it, Brian, in some way, shape, or form.
I mean, Pete got three movies four now about the Bay. He got a Steph Curry doc coming out next month.
Second greatest player of all time, but we'll talk about that later.
Second.
Man, we could talk all of that, Charlamagne. I mean, you know, that's a nice ranking for him. But we met then. He was making a doc called The Waiting Room, which is about Highland Hospital, which is a, you know, a massive hospital in East Oakland that has a trauma ward, you know, and it was actually the hospital where Oscar Grant, rest in peace, where he was born, and the hospital where he passed away when he was murdered, and we were trying to get access to that place, and some folks in the San Francisco Film Society hooked me and Pete up, and we've been tight since. And some years back, my wife, Zinzi Evans, and my partner, Seva Kohanian, we started a company called Proximity Media. And a few years after we started, we recruited Pete to come over and run nonfiction for us. So he's been making films, for our company for some time now. And this is the first one that we've done in collaboration with Onyx.
So
I always like to ask people from the beginning, both of you guys, Pete and Ryan, like, how did you get into film? For somebody out there right now listening, how was the start? What was the love? What was the first light bulb that said, this is what I wanted to do? And how was that journey of getting into the game?
I was like, I come from a big family. My mom's one of 10, dad's one of 8. And we had big family reunions, lots of cousins running around. My Uncle Ray had a video camera and he'd bring to the family reunions every summer. And I would take the camera and run around and interview all my family members. I had I didn't have the King's chairs, but I had the Pete Nick show,
right?
This little show, and a clip from that is actually in an autobiographical. My first film was an autobiographical documentary about the impact that my addiction. I went to Howard University and fell into addiction.
Sorry.
And my film.
I meant the Howard part. That went to him.
Ate you, the Mecca.
He went to Howard. I mean, I was talking about the Howard part. That's what I wanted to say. I said the Howard part.
You are nuts, bro.
I went to Hampton, so you know, but go ahead.
I for sure was like, yo, he got empathy.
It's empathy. Forget your addiction. You went to Howard.
No, I was with you on that. I was ready to go down the road with you on that. But my, you know, it was really... my story, it's a story of a black family, upper middle class black family that dealt with things that were difficult to talk about. And I just from the very early age was inspired by my own family story and felt that there was something there that I wasn't seeing, heard, and told. And that really began my journey as a storyteller. Later, when I went to film school and had a choice to make my first film, it was to look within.
I know that you probably should go watch the autobiographical doc you did, but what was the addiction?
Co- You name it. Like, okay. Depends on the day. Depends on my mood.
So you just got turned out in college? Yeah, or were you trying to stay up to study? Or?
I was working at this is the late 80s during the war on drugs. This is when Rafel Edmund, Marion Barry. I was working at a club, the Fifth Column, and just got sucked into the world. I was, you know, dealing with a lot of identity issues. And I think, you know, it's so interesting that I met Ryan eventually, and his process of storytelling, looking at the black story, the black family, the black American story, and reframing that in a powerful way is a bit of a kismet.
That's so interesting, because there's always a profile of what an addict looks like, you know, and somebody who was attending an HBCU probably wouldn't fit that profile, so to speak.
Well, you know, one of the things I learned being at Howard was that being black means so many different things. Okay. It sort of like exploded my mind, you know, on that. And we have these conceptions that black in the media is, you know, more flattened out into a two-dimensional narrative. And so that was also one of the things I wanted to bring into my storytelling.
And you, Ryan, for people that don't know?
How did I get into filmmaking?
How you got into filmmaking? What was the first light bulb? What made you say, this is what I want to do as a profession?
That's a great question. For me, I grew up in I grew up in the Bay Area, bro. Playing football and going to school. I like school. I like football maybe a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Got a scholarship to go to a school called St. Mary's College. And this was in 2003. Very good basketball school. Mm-hmm. You know, but they had some, you know, they had football there as well, playing in D1AA. And after my freshman season, they dropped their football program. And that same semester, it was like we were doing spring ball, and they dropped that bomb on us. And I was in a English class, like a creative writing class, taught by a woman named Rosemary Graham. And she gave the first assignment for us to write about our most intense emotional experience. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about something that happened, like a health issue that happened with my pop. Didn't think much about it, you know, turned it in. And then she called me into her office hours, and had like a one-on-one with me and was like, hey, you should think about writing screenplays, you know? Mm. That was really like the first time an adult recommended something like that. And I thought it was a crazy recommendation too.
So you've never been into it? You were just like, let me...
I mean, looking back, it was always there. Like, my family watched a lot of movies. Mm. That was how we would pass time. It was how we would communicate with each other, you know? And I've done a lot of self-analysis since then, like a lot, you know, a little bit of like what Pete's talking about. Looking back, my parents came up, both of them from Oakland, and they was there when you know, that time Pete's talking about at Howard. My parents was in the town, and it wasn't much different. They was trying to stay alive, man. You know, young married, and they would they would do for entertainment is like, you know, go to Blockbuster and rent something and stay in the house. You know what I mean? Had three sons, they would keep us in the house. So that's what we would do. It's like that was our culture, you know. And I always loved movies. You know, I'll do like theater arts or whatever. If it was an elective, I'll take theater arts. You know what I'm saying? Right. So it was always there. But her reading something that I wrote and making that suggestion was huge, man. And then my wife, who was my girl at the time, you know, I taught her about it. I was trying to write screenplays in Microsoft Word, which is difficult if y'all ever tried to write a screenplay before, because of the margins and everything.
The formatting.
It's goofy, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then my wife, she was on track scholarship at Fresno State. We both didn't have no money. She squeezed our coins together and got me the software that you use, you know, to professionally write a screenplay, Final Drive. So once she did that, you know, I was in there. You know what I mean?
Well, you remember the first screenplay you wrote?
I do, bro. I mean, I remember all of them. I mean, it was terrible, but yeah, it was called Story of a Dollar. It was about a $20 bill that was getting passed around the Bay, you know. So we told a bunch of little stories based on that. People would write on the money. Mm-hmm. It sounds crazy now, right? Because everything digital. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But that
Chris,
was
Chris Rock did a sketch like that once.
Oh
for
yeah,
his, for his Chris Rock show on HBO.
Yeah. So it was. This was like, you know, yeah. This was like '03. It's a common. You know, it's a common idea. You know what I mean? Like an inanimate object that's getting moved around. You get to tell stories through that. But when I was, you know, I was 17, man. So I was like, yo, this is the most creative shit ever. You know what I mean? I didn't know.
When did y'all both know it was going to be a profession, right? Because I'm sure at one time you thought you were going to play football in the league. You know what I mean? I'm sure one time you thought you were going to do something else. When did y'all know, like, this is a profession?
Well, I'll tell you the time when I knew this one had a profession was before I saw Fruitvale Station. I saw a film he did called Locks, which to this day is one of the most beautiful expressions of character and humanity that I've seen in a short film. It was like a silent film almost, and I knew that this was a special you know storyteller, and then that was sort of what drew me to Ryan. And and what was your question?
I would say, when did you know it was going to be a profession? You know, everybody wants to be a football player, basketball player. Everybody has that dream. But when you say, no, this is my calling.
Well, I was at Howard. I was on the 11-year plan at Howard.
11-year plan.
It was interrupted by my stay with the federal government. when I got out, you know, I kind of bounced around in D.C. for a couple years, met my wife, Vonna, in 94. Sort of got things on track and started. I had to pick a minor, and I was a creative writing major. I was going to be a writer. That's what I thought I was going to do. I was writing, you know, short stories, yep. And never got to writing a script. But I had to pick a minor. I picked journalism, and I'd met this kid in an AA meeting, and he worked at this little tiny news service called the Hispanic Link, which at the time there were very little. There's very little news telling the story of the Hispanic community in America. So this tiny hole-in-the-wall news service in D.C. was syndicated nationwide, and it was run by this white guy who'd married this woman from Oaxaca, Mexico, and it was a love story. And so I was just struck by it, and so I made a little short documentary, and it was my thesis project, my senior project at Howard. And I fell in love with the documentary, and I looked at where the best, you know, documentary programs, and UC Berkeley, the journalism school at Berkeley, has one of the top programs. And so I went there. When I made that decision to apply to graduate school, I kind of knew, like, this is what I'm committing to do. This is what I'm going for.
Right. And you, Ryan, when did you know that this was going to be your profession? Because I know at one time you said, I'm going to play in the league. I know you thought you were going to play for the Raiders.
Big time. Yeah, no. It's a great question. I've been asked it before. My wife always laughed. But it was after I made my fourth movie. It was when I was like, okay, I'm going to be doing this for a while.
Mm. What was the fourth one?
Wakanda Forever. that's when you
said this is a profession. I think it could have been before that one.
No, I'm telling you, bro.
The Fruitvale, Creed, Black Panther, and Wakanda Forever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause I don't know, like I some combination of like imposter syndrome.
That's what I was gonna say. That sounds like
and imposter. And internalizing this internalized feeling of it's like it's all gonna be taken away from me. You know what I'm saying? Like that. It just went away.
So you didn't think you were good enough?
It was a combination of a lot of things. For one, I didn't think I was good enough. Like I was thinking I was fooling people. I got lucky with each movie, you know what I'm saying? But I think like we were kind of forever going through so much. You know, number one, losing Chad.
Chad would pass.
You know,
rest in
number
peace.
One, losing Chad, rest in peace, man. And he had so much confidence in me, you know what I'm saying? And he would speak, you know, he would speak confidence in me when I was having moments of doubt. And a lot of times I would think he was just trying to get me through the day. You know what I'm saying? Because you do that with your teammates, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, you got this. Even though you might not believe they really got it, but you tell them. You know what I'm saying? But then in retrospect, after he passed, and knowing what I knew about him, that he would never BS somebody. You know what I'm saying? In finishing that film, and that was like the first time I was like, okay, I think I'm gonna be doing this for the rest of my life.
How nerve wracking was that film with all those celebrities and all those stars and people that's been in so many movies?
The first one,
yeah,
man, crazy nerve wracking, bro. But the thing is, all my movies was nerve wracking. My nerves was racked on the short he was talking about, you know. So I mean, you know that feeling, you know, and like
you don't ever get to a point where you're like, I've done enough where I'm comfortable and
I'm getting there. Yeah, like I think I'm getting there, you know. You
know, never to a point where you're comfortable.
Yeah, where I feel like I'm gonna be doing this for some time.
I would say confident. You're confident in you.
Getting there.
Right.
Getting there.
Also, I think it's a belief that your voice what you have to say is going to be received. Mm. You know, it's going to be received by the culture, by the critics, by the audiences. And our culture sort of shifts. And those voices, the voices that do matter, that do bubble up to the surface, it's not always because of the relevance or the power of those voices. It's sort of the ecosystem of our culture and society allows certain voices to come forward.
Is it the pressure of knowing how many young minorities look up to you guys, like, I want to be the next? You know what I mean? Is that part of it as well?
Yeah, man. It's so much. It's all of it, bro. Like y'all feel it. Y'all black. You know what I'm saying? You know, when you get it, when you first got this job, it's like, I got to do my thing for my family, but I also got to do my thing for the next person who look like me who want to do this.
That came later. At first, it was just about survival, right? You know, because I had been fired from 4 times from radio, so it was about survival.
So, yeah.
Then once you start to realize the magnitude of the platform, it's like, you got to do it for the people.
Yeah. And what's great is, like, look, right, it's Monday, right? I ain't checked the papers, but I think Stephen Cable's movie was number one.
Transformers yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was number one. Yeah, so like, Pete got this movie coming. We got a Steph Doc that's going to come in a like, The more that's of us that's succeeding, it actually takes some of the pressure off. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? That has also helped. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, oh, it's only one. Mm-hmm. We got one shot. We got one representative. It's like, it's a bunch of us. You know what I'm saying? And that's changing the fabric of what a blockbuster director looks like.
How much.
How much support a nonfiction film gets from a studio or from the audience? You know what I'm saying?
Which is typically very little.
Yeah,
so I'm extremely grateful for the platform that proximity has provided, and that is a powerful idea to sort of validate not just different perspectives of voice, but different genres and styles of storytelling.
Mm-hmm. One more thing about the imposter syndrome: when you're Ryan Coogler, and we know the greatness of Ryan Coogler, but the media will say things like, oh, he's the next George Lucas. Like, you're always the next somebody. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Never just you. Does that?
Hold on, bro. Is that a Crown Royal bag?
Of course.
Okay. My bad, bro.
Charlamagne's 60. He keeps all his change
bro.
In there.
That's change.
You damn right. You need a little something?
Man, I might. I got a vending machine here. Hey, my bad, bro. I just went back 100 years,
bro. Bro, bad memories,
bro.
Yeah. Grandma.
Major, bro. Uncles, bro.
Uncles.
Oh my God. My bad, Charlamagne.
But I was just saying, does that contribute to the imposter syndrome? Them always saying you're the next someone.
It don't help.
Right.
That never helps. You know, but what I'm thankful for, man, is I'm thankful for the OGs. I saw Spielberg a few days ago. You know. Spent a day with Spike. You know, I sat down with Coppola. I sat down with Chris Nolan. You know, I was very, rest in peace, John Singleton, was very close with him, you know. Mm-hmm. And having a relationship with the OGs is helpful if they say you the next whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I sat with George Lucas, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know these guys as guys, and they can kind of advise and say, man, throw all that away. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. You know, like this is gonna come, that's gonna come. It's been really, really helpful. It never helps to hear somebody compare you to a generational great. You know what I'm saying? That's why I always feel for Bron.
We'll never appreciate Bron. I say that all the time. You'll never appreciate Bron if you keep comparing him to this ghost.
Bro,
that is Michael Jordan.
Let me tell you something, bro. Me and Zinzi went to game. When the damn Lakers knocked us out, bro, in the second round, and we worked with Steph and Bron, we worked mm-hmm. on Space Jam, and we worked on the beautiful movie Pete's got coming out, and this dude, man, is 38, and he would have plays, bro, because he knew me and Zinzi was there. He would have plays where he would get the ball, bro. He would point to us, score. And then point to us after he scored. Like, y'all, I'm about to score right now. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. and it would just do it. I've never seen anything like this guy, man. Mm. And everything he does is always compared to
to Jordan, yeah.
Or you know, or his Kareem. You know, he was doing it. Mm-hmm. It's like it's
They didn't want to do the jump hook that day.
We can't appreciate it for comparison's sake, you know. But I will say, like, this whole time I've had Pete, bro. You know what I'm saying? As a friend, who you know, people don't know him as much as they might know George Lucas or Spielberg, but incredible working filmmaker and a family man. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Who got wisdom for me whenever I need it in terms of navigation. So I'll be forever thankful for him and to help him make this beautiful movie, man, Anthem, that only he could make. You know, y'all can talk to him more about it, but only he could make a movie where, you know, it's like, yo, we gonna examine this national institution. You know what I'm saying? That's got all of these, that's triggering for everybody, you know, and come out with a song on the other side. You come out watching the movie feeling good, you know. But yeah, like, I'm thankful for him too.
Thank you, bro.
You know, Pete, it made me wonder watching Anthem, why did black people ever accept the anthem to begin with? Like, why did they ever accept the national anthem to begin with?
I don't know, you know, I've seen it from a lot of different perspectives. You know, I guess I like to say I was born into the story of race. I was born in 68.
Oh, wow.
My birth mother's white. My birth father was black. Her family threatened to disown her if she married him. Mm-hmm. She put me up for adoption. I was adopted by a black family. My dad's descendant of slaves from the South, Gullah. My mom's...
South Carolina. Hey.
Yep.
That's home.
My mom, her parents came over from West Africa, Cape Verde. I married a woman, a refugee from Laos. I've got kids who are mixed race. Been in federal prison on a drug charge. Went to all white private schools, went to Howard. So I've seen life from all these different angles and perspectives in all my work. At the same time, I've never been thrown down on the ground by a cop. I've been called nigger a couple times, but that's usually when I'm with my other family. People don't kind of know how to pin me. You know, and I generally can slide through.
Like miscellaneous.
Kind of miscellaneous.
Yeah.
And that also sort of burrowed into my own psyche about my identity. Who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that question of who am I is also the question I think as a country we're trying to sort of grapple with. Who are we? We're all different, but we're all the same. And I think all of my work, I like to step into spaces that are a little bit, that are messy. And examining those questions, whether it's, you know, what are our values as a country in delivering health care to Americans and, you know, setting that in a public hospital waiting room. What does it mean if a police department says they're trying to reform? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And is that real? How important is education, you know, to equity in our culture? And so, you know, the anthem was sort of a natural examining that question of, you know, should you love it or hate it? Should we tear it down? Should we burn it? Should we recreate it? Some people love it. Some people hate it. I love Jimi Hendrix version. To me, was always like beyond, like it went into some spiritual place. It was still the anthem. It's still the Star Spangled Banner at the end of the day. Marvin Gaye's version, Jose Feliciano, you know, these are all beautiful renditions of a song that is being unpacked. But it's still the anthem, and I felt that was a great starting point to sort of, you know, think about, well, what would it mean to create a new anthem? And if we were to create a new anthem today and allow the diversity of voice in this country to create that song, what would that be? And on the surface, it's an impossible task,
because
you can't really. We were like, do we need to, like, you know, get into sort of like blues, hip hop, gospel, jazz, like rock, house music, go-go. I mean, there's so many different styles of music that reflect the American story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there could be another two or three movies, using this construct.
One thing I do love is, you know, Anthem, besides Anthem, I love the evolution story, right? Because a lot of times in this day and age, people don't allow you to evolve, right? Mm-hmm. They look at your past and they try to keep you in the past of who you were. And the fact that you talk about everything that you've been through and how you've changed and the things that you're doing, I don't think a lot of times people allow people to have that evolution and to change. So I commend that. And have you had a hard time because of your past? Because, you know, Charlamagne and myself, we've all had a past and we talk about our past. And the reason we talk about it is because, you know, nobody's ever perfect, right? There's no life that's perfect. People go through shit. So the fact that you talk about the things that you've been through and you're still able to leave your mark on the world on some positive is the amazing story.
I think, I don't know why, you know, I You know, when I remember distinctly when I got out of prison, I got a job working at this elementary school in D.C., which, you know, I went back to Howard, and they have like an internship program where you fill out, you know, where do you want to work? And I kind of went into the space of denial of what had happened to me, and I didn't check the box. Mm-hmm. You know, I basically lied. And I got placed at this elementary school, which happened to be a school where, like, presidents, like where Obama sends his kids, where like some of those powerful people in D.C. send their kids. And I remember I took the job. I was working at this job. And one day the lawyer who represented me in my case, which was prosecuted by Merrick Garland, who's now the Attorney General of the United States, walked in on a tour with his son. And my job that day was to like check all the parents in and give them name tags. And here comes my lawyer.
Oh boy.
And he sees me and we looked at each other and he was like, oh, how are you doing? And he's probably thinking to himself, what the hell is this guy doing? This convicted drug trafficker working at the school that presumably I'm going to send my kid. And, you know, I eventually left that job and I had to tell all the people, you know, that I had lied. And from that point forward, I decided that I was going to tell my story. I was going to step into the difficult space of being real about my story, talking about my dad's alcoholism, asking my dad about his alcoholism on camera. We had never talked. Black families don't talk about their trauma,
no,
their mental health, things like alcoholism. And it just felt like an empowering thing. And it also felt like something that our country needed to do more, was examine and step into these more real, authentic spaces.
I mean, we are all those things. I want to ask about Anthem. What do you think it would take to actually create a new national anthem?
Well, one of the insights that seemed very common as we asked that same question to a lot of people in the making of the film, and also now that the film is coming out, is that maybe there can't be one anthem. Mm. You know, there has to be many anthems. I mean, the idea of anthem is so, you know, there's the anthem, the national anthem, but then there's like personal anthems, the song you put on at the gym, or the song that you that you recall when you got married, or the song that just gets you hyped, you know, something that inspires you. You know, we all have different ways of allowing these songs, and these, because songs are ultimately stories, they're narratives, the narratives that we tell ourselves and the narratives that we use to reflect, you know, our families, our communities, and that can't be boiled down into one song, but that the intention of allowing, you know, multiple perspectives to inform a national anthem, a national story, wasn't how the original song was created, that Francis Scott Key was created using the music of, you know, this British, you know, pub song. Mm-hmm. And so that intention could lead to other insights and meaning that we could carry, you know, into our future as a country.
The doc also had me thinking, if there was a new national anthem, what genre of music would it be delivered through? Because I love the way y'all went through country, which I never even referred to as white. When you referred to it as white soul, I was like, oh, what is white soul? You know what I mean?
Isn't that interesting?
Blues, jazz, like what genre of music would it be best delivered through to where America would embrace it?
I was having this conversation with the dude outside the cellar last night. I think, what's his name? David or Brian? And I asked him that, and immediately he was like, hip-hop. Hip-hop. And I'm 68. I was born in 68, so I am the age of hip-hop. And we talked about it, you know, because we brought on Dahi early in the process, and Dahi has produced some of, you know, hip-hop's
Kendrick Lamar,
greatest artists.
So many different people.
Yeah. And
so good, bro.
You know.
It was weird to hear him say that he's only been to New York and L.A. too. I was like, wow, that he hasn't been in the middle of America. I thought that was weird. That was... Yeah.
A lot of us haven't. A lot of us, you know, don't enter these spaces. We grow up in our communities. We sometimes step out, sometimes. But there are, you know, definitely places in the South or Nashville. It's like you saw what happened when they pulled up and what are y'all doing? And they didn't fully articulate what they were doing.
Yeah.
They said, what are y'all doing? You know, we're making a documentary exploring American music. They didn't say we're making a documentary rewriting the national anthem,
sure.
you know. So I do think, but I think, you know,
you're saying hip hop should be
hip hop, like that is, you know, gospel, you know, house music, all these things are inflections. But, you know, the blues thing, we knew that there were certain foundational places that we wanted to explore. Blues is one of those foundational places. Native American music, which is very rarely included in the conversation of the American music story, mm-hmm. we knew that we wanted to step into those spaces and allow them to inform the song.
The movie made me, the doc made me think that hip hop tonight is rooted in soul and spirit as it should be. It feels like a lot of the hip hop is rooted in, that we listen to now is rooted in capitalism, more so than the stuff that y'all had in the doc, that when you listen to the blues and the country, like it was the Native American stuff, it was rooted in soul and spirit. Why do you think that is, Ryan?
That's a heavy question, bro. I'm older today than I've ever been. I think music is complicated. I think black music is I got my own theories about it. I love that this doc is kind of about American music. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like it's anthem on the surface, but it's really about American music and about watching a song being written, which I think is fascinating. Cause you got stand up comedy, and you got music. I think them is like two, like it's a straight alchemy. You know what I'm saying? Like when you see people do it. And I think that black music has always been a call back home, like a report. Hey, we still here. Hey, we okay. Like this, here's what's happening. You know what I'm saying? Is anybody out there to hear us? You know, I always feel this electricity runs through my body whenever I come to New York. I think a part of it is just that it's 10 million people running around trying to make a way. But another part of it is this force that's been ever present in my life that's given me a sense of power. Hip hop, it was founded here. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And you can feel it. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's that I know it was here or that I can feel it here, but it's fantastic. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think that things constantly change. And I think the reason why you hearing this trend towards like hyper capitalistic, or you know, it's, a lot of it's like war music. You know what I'm saying? Like, but I think it's like about the right to self determine that people are looking for, and whatever route they can find it. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes, sometimes maybe it's quote unquote misguided. Sometimes it's truthful. You know what I mean? Like. Somebody that's living in poverty, surrounded by it, they might think that having some money is a way they can self-determine, make themselves safe, get their family out of where they are. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes they think picking up a weapon is a way to self-determine. If they feeling vulnerable or weak, you know what I'm saying? I gotta show that I'm strong and I'm not. You know what I mean? I think it's usually some form of truth in it. You know what I'm saying? Whether you know at 37, you know what I'm saying, I'm loving it. Not, you know what I mean. That's my best explanation for it. But I think that's what everybody wants. I think that's what's so interesting about it. You know what I'm saying? Like I come from the home of the Panthers. It's all about the right to self-determine. You know what I'm saying? To claim my humanity and self-determine how my safety and where I can go, where my body can be, where my children can feel safe. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I hear that in the blues, I hear that in jazz, I hear that in, you know what I'm saying? I hear it in all of it, you know? Hope that answers that question, bro.
Yeah, I guess when you was talking, it made me feel like, damn, sometimes I guess capitalism can ruin art, right? So I wonder what's more fulfilling for you, doing something like Fruitvale Station or Black Panther?
What's more fulfilling?
Yeah, or just, not even just those two movies in particular, but just doing a movie like in more of an independent way than the big blockbuster.
That's a great question, bro. I think at the time I've been blessed to do the most fulfilling thing. You know what I'm saying? Like at the time, you know, and we talked about that, like how we don't get the ability to change, right? I think as black people, we can be the hardest on ourselves when it comes to that. You know what I'm saying? Like I was born in Oakland. My whole family's from there.
We know.
I think,
Ryan.
I was like, but check it out, bro. I'm getting somewhere, bro. But you know, like I was like 8 or 9, we moved to Richmond. You know what I'm saying? And like still to this day, I have people ask me, hey bro, you from Oakland or Richmond? You know what I'm saying?
Word.
And like the truth is, come from both. You know what I'm saying? But that's not allowed at home. You know what I mean? Like, you gotta pick, bro. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, is it this or is it that? And you gotta stick with it for your whole life. You know what I'm saying? Like when I'm blessed a little to be 100, hey, bro, you from Oakland? You know what I'm saying? It's like, well, damn.
You
know
what I'm saying? You ever go back to Oakland and say, you know, it's like, damn, I made it out of here.
I'm still there.
He's there.
Yeah, you know, I'm still there.
Ryan Oakland to the core.
No, I know.
But it's beautiful, though. I'm from South Carolina, so I know exactly how you feel.
Some days where I'm like, damn, I'm still alive. You know what I'm saying?
Because I was out in Oakland, and I'm driving. I was staying at the hotel, and I wanted to get something to eat. It's like, go to the next corner. And the next corner was Oakland. Like, fresh fries spots with the gates in it. I'm like, where the fuck am I? And, like, you still see, like, it looks like riots happened yesterday. Like, you see stuff boarded up and stuff broken down. Yeah. And I'm like, God damn.
Don't let him play you like Queens. No, it's so sexy, Ryan.
Are you in Queens?
I'm from Queens.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's
so it's like when you see that.
Wherever we at, you'll see that. You know, you could be on the right or the wrong spot. Mm-hmm. You know, look, man, the country been at war with us since we've been here. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like it's the truth. Like you see it reflected. Like whether it's financial, you know, like whether it's all, you know, outright Jim Crow, whether it was, you know, full blown. You know, our bodies being illegal, you know what I'm saying? Like, like, you know, so you see the reflections of it, you know what I mean? And it's spots in Cleveland and
everywhere
here, Detroit, Oakland, you know what I'm saying? You know, you go DC.
I'm gonna try to formulate how I'm gonna say this, because there's a lot in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Going back to your question about what's, you know, the independent versus the blockbuster and capitalism.
Oh, shit, yeah, I forgot
about
that question.
But I saw Black Panther in a theater in Utah where my daughter was in treatment for mental health and addiction. She was 16 at the time. And we were visiting her, and we went to see Black Panther in a theater packed full of white Mormons watching Black Panther. And to me, that was a profound reality and impact that Ryan's work, this very commercial, big blockbuster Marvel movie, I don't think people fully sort of understand the impact that had on the culture and sort of changing the narrative. And, you know, changing those narratives is so important. It's important internally. Talking about trauma, talking about our communities, Black communities going back generations, back to slavery, like my dad's family. He had unresolved trauma, you know, he was drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I only found out after he died that he was told when he was a young man to step into the gutter when white people approached him, you know, on the sidewalk. My daughter, you know, I dealt with addiction. My daughter dealt with addiction, and we lost her at the age of 16. So the consequences of sort of unrecognized and trauma that's not dealt with in narrative is profound. And I think Ryan's work is doing it both in this very intimate way with sort of an independent approach like Fruitvale Station, and on the biggest stage with these blockbusters is powerful. And I think it's also going to influence other creatives in those spaces to use their voices and to use these stages, because now we're getting more opportunities.
That's why I like Black Panther 2 so much, because I put Ryan in the same vein as like a Kendrick or even a Cole, because even with the massive success, you won't compromise your art.
I appreciate that, bro. I'm just realizing I didn't ask you a question, man. They all are fulfilling at the time, because I'm different each time. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, met Fruitvale when I was 25, 37 now, you know. I don't know if I can make that movie now. You know what I'm saying? I don't got the optimism that I had then, or the energy. You know, we met in like 20 days. We didn't sleep. You know what I'm saying? I gotta sleep now. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, our family now, you know, like it would have been impossible. But that was the most fulfilling thing that I could have done at that time. And I've been blessed to like do fulfilling work. You know what I'm saying? With this company. Bro, it's fantastic. I get to support filmmakers' vision. You know what I'm saying? Like Pete said, hey, I'm gonna make a movie. We're gonna make a new national anthem. I'm like, holy shit, let's do it. What do you need? You know what I'm saying? How can I help? You know, and it's been an incredible blessing, man.
I know these brothers gotta go too.
Yeah, I know they're telling us you gotta wrap up. So I guess with this question be the last question. How do you keep the national anthem hopeful and empowering with so much of America's history being negative for the majority of groups that have been here. Because, you know, we keep talking about we are having these discussions about what America is. Mm-hmm. I think we know what America is. We trying to put the mirror up to them and let them see what America is.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's different things and different people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's what's so beautiful mm-hmm. about the song they made was that, you know, you got four women from different backgrounds and different experiences with the country, you know, putting down verses that feel true to them. Mm-hmm. That's not compromising. And then when you hear it sang, you know, it's like, you know, you identify with each piece. Because maybe it's like, I don't know somebody who's indigenous. Or I'm not indigenous myself to this land, but I know people who are, you know. And I know people who are having issues with borders moving across them and back and forth mm-hmm. or getting more, you know. And when you hear the words sang, you feel it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't, you know, when you hear Charity, like in her 20s from Nashville, sing about her family in the military, I think she says like all gave some, but some gave all. Man, you feel it. You know what I'm saying? And white people don't own the military. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. My grandfather fought in every war that was fought while he was alive. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so when you take a step back and look at the song that they made and the process of how they made it, man, that, you know, the young choir sang it, man, and it works. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so I think it's an incredible utility mm-hmm. that they gave. And that's all a song is a utility, man. You might use it to get through a personal loss. You might use it to do your homework. You might use it to lift at the gym. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Like it's a piece of art that's a utility. And it's up to the people to use it. You know what I'm saying? Absolutely. How you feel about people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just real simply empowering people to tell their story, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, anthems inspiring people to express their own idea of an anthem. I remember when we made The Waiting Room, this film about Highland Hospital, before we made the film, we did this little digital storytelling project where we interviewed hundreds of people stuck in the waiting room. We asked everybody the same thing: what are you waiting for? And the results of that simple question were profound. And I got into the, you know, you're dealing with some people who look dangerous, somebody who just pissed on themselves, somebody who's ranting, dealing with mental illness. And I got into this space where I was approaching everybody, even if I was uncomfortable. Mm. And some of the people that I was most uncomfortable with, mm-hmm. the results in their story, allowing them, empowering them in that moment to tell their story, even if I didn't maybe agree with their politics or their position, because some people were talking about healthcare, some people were conservative in those spaces, mm-hmm. but they're also suffering somehow. And that sort of collective, that unifying suffering, and allowing people the framework to tell their story in that space was powerful. And I think hopefully this film can allow people to recognize that sometimes we do have to put these stories that are difficult next to each other and allow the alchemy to just happen, because we just can't ignore it. We're in a difficult time in our country right now. It's like we're at a crossroads right now. And it could go this way, it could go that way. But the optimism, both for my own family and the generational trauma that we face, that there's a path out, that you don't have to stay in that.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you brothers for joining us. And, you know, anytime you got a movie or something that you want to promote, documentary, y'all invited up here, come on up and use the platform.
All right, what's next? I mean, the writers' crack happening now.
Man, it's big shout out to the writers. WGA is striking right now. You know, trying to get... You know, equity.
Underrated. That's next for us, like on the nonfiction.
On the nonfiction side, yes. Yeah, so nonfiction, mm-hmm.
You can do.
Yes, yeah, it's not started with WGA, originated work. You know what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. outside of that, so I can help promote. But yeah, we got Underrated, beautiful movie about Steph Curry.
Very underrated. He's the number two greatest player of all time. We need to start acting like it.
It's coming full circle.
And hey, let me ask you guys, what y'all think? Who's not, look, top three NBA? Let's talk about it right now. Just quick question before you go. Top five?
In the league right now?
No, all time.
All time.
I can give you mine quick.
LeBron's in there.
I got Michael Jordan, MJ. Steph Curry, Kobe Bryant, LeBron, and Magic Johnson. That's my top five.
Yeah. I'm not mad at that.
Yeah. I mean, that's... I'm not doing this, man. I made a movie with Bron. I made a movie with Steph. You know what I'm saying? I'm not doing this.
Beat LeBron three times in NBA finals.
I'm a Warriors fan, lifelong. Word. You know what I'm saying? Like Steph,
He's baiting you in, Ryan.
It's gotta matter.
Steph, no. Steph bigger than basketball for us.
He revolutionized the sport.
Yeah, like we ride or die with Steph. You know what I'm saying? And Bron's my guy.
Steph changed all the basketball, women and men. They all play like Steph. He revolutionized the game. I've never seen nobody do that since Michael Jordan.
You're not wrong. I'm gonna tell you something that's gonna sound crazy. To this day, most skilled basketball player I ever seen is Hakeem Olajuwon. Mm. Like, most skilled. Mm-hmm. I remember watching him as a kid and being like, yo, this dude's crazy. The scariest cat I ever seen to play against when I was a kid was Tim Duncan. It seemed like he was just always winning. You know what I'm saying? These dudes don't get mentioned at all when you start talking about it. When I really think about it, I'm like, I don't know how somebody could be better than Hakeem Olajuwon.
Now you got the Jokics and those guys. Yeah. And they kind of, and I love Hakeem, but they
But back then it wasn't too many big men. So when you were a big man,
it was all big men.
He swept Shaq.
They were all big. You didn't have it, like, you know.
He had to go past David Robinson.
David Robinson. You had Patrick Ewing.
Dikembe Mutombo.
What he used to do to those guys, bro? Like, I used to just, and he had no flaws in his game.
But now, like, you think about somebody smaller had to get by the big man, like your Allen Iverson.
AI, bro. He don't get
think about what AI did. You know what I mean?
When he beat that Kobe Shaq team game one, and no teammates really. I mean, I don't mean no disrespect. These are real hoopers that was on his team. But, like, you know, I mean, yeah, bro. So it's tough, man.
You're saying all that to say you do think Steph is better than Bron, but.
Bro, I'm gonna bait you, Ryan.
Bro, I'm not.
You just don't want.
I'm a Warriors fan, bro. That's what I'm gonna say, bro. And Steph, and Steph, bigger than a hoop for us, man. Right. You know what I'm saying? But I'm also a black man, and LeBron is bigger than. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know.
Love Bron.
I'm not gonna get into that.
I'm just talking about on the court.
I love both these guys. I root for the Warriors. I root for the Warriors when they play.
Just on the court.
I root for the Warriors when they play. Right. I love both those dudes. I hate that we got. I hate it. I hate it so much. And I hate that they knocked us out. God damn, bro.
Pete says it with his chest. Steph is number two of all time.
I give it. Absolutely.
He's from Boston.
Absolutely.
You from where?
I mean, Boston? I grew up in Boston, so, you know, boy. Larry Bird. You know.
Oh, boy.
Larry Bird's in my, yeah, I know. Red Sox fan too? I know. Let's not go there.
And you went to Howard.
Let's not go there.
Oh, boy.
Although 2004, Yankees.
Oh,
Red
boy.
Sox.
All right, well, there you have it. Peter Nix, the Howard University alumni. Hey. Ryan Cooper,
the real
H.U. Well, we appreciate you, brothers, for joining us, man. It's the Breakfast Club. Don't forget Anthem, June 28th on Hulu. It's the Breakfast Club. Good morning.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh, my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm, change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.